The cleanup squad finally made its appearance, with a meat wagon not far behind. Two guard constables chalked a rough outline around the headless body and made laborious notes about the state of the corpse. The forensic sorcerer waited impatiently for them to finish, already in a foul mood at being dragged from his bed so early in the morning. Hawk and Fisher leaned against a wall together, drinking the late sorcerer's wine and trying to put together some kind of report that wouldn't get them both busted down to constable or beyond. The two constables unhurriedly compared notes and then got out of the way so that the forensic sorcerer could do his stuff. He glared venomously at them, then knelt down by the body and rolled up his sleeves. Hawk and Fisher looked at each other and unanimously decided this might be a good time to get some fresh air. On the spot, autopsies tended to be thorough, but messy. Hawk drained the last of the wine from the bottle he and Fisher had been passing back and forth. It was a piss-poor vintage, but the sourness suited his mood. No matter what kind of report he and Fisher eventually handed in, he had no doubt they were both in real trouble. They left Grimm's quarters and clattered down the creaking exterior stairway to the street below. The meat wagon's horses tossed their heads and snorted loudly, their breath steaming on the chill air. Hawk looked away. Reminders of his own mortality made him uncomfortable. Strange lights flared in the windows above as the forensic sorcerer set about dismantling Grimm's remaining wards and shields and defusing any booby traps that hadn't yet been triggered. Fisher hugged herself as a cold wind swept by.
I can't help thinking we're missing something, Hawk. We know why Fenris came here, to get a new face. But how did Grimm get involved with Fenris in the first place? He had a nice little racket going here. Judging by the records we found, he was already making more money than he knew what to do with. So why risk it all by dealing with a traitor? He didn't need the money, and there's nothing in his file to suggest he was at all political.
Maybe he just liked the excitement, the intrigue. He wouldn't be the first fool to be seduced by dreams of making history, of playing with the real shakers and movers. Or maybe he just had some kind of grudge against the council and saw this as his chance for revenge. I've known stranger motives. Doesn't make much difference now, anyway. The man is dead, and our case died with him. Odds are we'll never find out what it was all about.
Hawk shook his head gingerly as the guard communication sorcerer's deep ringing sound faded away.
I think I preferred it when I used the gong. That damn bell goes right through me.
Captains Hawk and Fisher are to report to Commander Dubois at guard headquarters immediately. This instruction has top priority. All other orders are rescinded.
Didn't take long for the news to reach our superiors, did it?
Haven loves bad news. And you can bet there were people lining up for the chance to drop us in the soup. We've always been too honest to be popular.
What the hell? We've weathered worse storms than this.
Right. Just keep our heads down and it'll blow over.
You really believe that?
No. How about you?
No. Even so, Dubois had better not shout at me. I'm not in the mood for it. In fact, if he raises his voice to me, I think I'll hit him somewhere low and painful.
How's that gonna help us?
Well, it couldn't hurt.
True.
Hawk and Fisher had barely walked through the front door at guard headquarters when a constable appeared, seemingly from nowhere, and insisted on escorting them straight to Dubois' office. Other guards avoided Hawk's and Fisher's eyes as they made their way through the headquarters building. Word had got around that no one wanted to risk guilt by association. Hawk smiled humorlessly and let his hand drift down to the axe at his side. He glanced across at Fisher and saw that her hand was already resting on the pommel of her sword. The constable brought them to the door of Dubois' office.
Enter!
The constable opened the door and stood back for Hawk and Fisher to enter. Hawk strolled casually in, Fisher at his side. The constable shut the door behind them, remaining in the room. Now that was interesting to Hawk. It meant that the man had remained presumably to stand guard, to keep people out or in. Hawk smiled inwardly as he and Fisher bowed formally to Commander Dubois. If he and Fisher decided it was in their best interests to leave in a hurry, it would take a lot more than one guard constable to stop them. Dubois glared at Hawk and Fisher from behind his desk.
God, you're a mess. I've seen beggars in the Devil's Hook who look more presentable than you two do right now. You are a disgrace to your uniform.
Hawk looked down at himself and had to admit the commander had a point. His clothes were badly torn and soaked with blood from the various fights he got involved in that evening. A quick glance at Fisher revealed that she hadn't fared any better. Her furs were stained and matted from the garbage she'd fallen into outside Madame Zara's. And what with all the exertions of the evening, the fact was they both smelled pretty bad. Hawk had a sudden intense desire to stand upwind of himself. He looked back at Dubois and put on his best innocent face. Dubois glared at him even harder. The complete lack of hair on his head somehow made his scowl all the more impressive.
"And you've lost your cloak again, Hawk. What happened this time? Someone sneak up behind you, steal it while you weren't looking, eh? Where the hell is your cloak?"
Hawk had to stop and think.
"It's pinned to a wall in a spiritualist's house."
"I am not even going to ask what you were doing at a spiritualist's. I don't think my nerves could stand it. Do you realize, Hawk, you go through more new cloaks in a year than most guards use up in a lifetime service to the city? Do you know how much those cloaks cost?"
"Yes, because you always deduct the cost from my wages."
"You're damn right we do. You're not screwing up my budget for the year." "Perhaps you'd also like to explain why you failed to turn in your suppressor stone to the armory as ordered."
"Would that help to get us off the hook?"
"Not in the bloody least."
"Then I don't think I'll bother."
Dubois' face darkened.
"Be fair. It saved both our asses tonight. If the stone hadn't blown up in Grimm's face when it did, we might both have been killed."
"Meh, I could live with that."
Dubois picked up a sheet of paper from his desk and frowned at it. Hawk studied the commander's bowed head thoughtfully. Something was going on. Dubois should be tearing strips off them for letting Fenris get away, not carping about their appearance or niggling over lost cloaks and the illegal use of a suppressor stone. Dubois never made any secret of the fact that he didn't approve of Hawk and Fisher's methods, and was usually only too happy to find something about their work he could criticize. The Fenris debacle should have been just what he needed to bust them down to Constable, or worse. Instead, he hadn't even mentioned the spy. If he hadn't known better, Hawk would have sworn Dubois was trying to avoid telling them something unpleasant. Hawk's mind raced furiously. Maybe the Council found out about Fenris getting away and decided to blame everything on the two guards. It wouldn't be too hard for the Council to make out a case of treason against them. They could claim the guards deliberately let the spy escape, and then killed Grimm to cover their tracks. Hawk forced himself to calm down. It needn't be that bad. It could be that Dubois just had some really nasty job lined up for them as penance for failing to bring in Fenris. Now that was much more likely. Hawk began to relax a little. Whatever it was, he and Fisher could handle it. After 5 years working the north side, they could handle anything. Dubois carefully put down the piece of paper, tapped it with his fingers a few times, and then looked up at Hawk and Fisher.
"Well, well, for once in your lives, you struck it lucky. We know where Fenris is. The Council Circle of Sorcerers knew Grimm was somehow involved with the traitors and kept an unobtrusive watch on him. So when Fenris did a runner with his new face, they were able to follow him magically all the way to his new hiding place."
"Wait a minute. If we know where he is, why can't we just walk right in and grab him?"
"Unfortunately, it's not that simple."
"Somehow I didn't think it would be."
"Fenris has gone to ground at Tower MacNeil, just outside the city wall. That much the sorcerers are certain of. But seems our man has some sorcerer's protection of his own, presumably supplied by his superiors. Our people couldn't get close enough to see what his new face looks like."
"No problem. We burst in there, arrest everyone, and sort out which is Fenris later."
"Oh, well, you know, I thought that you would come up with something like that. Don't even think about it. The MacNeils are one of the oldest and most respected families in Avon. We don't dare touch them. If it should turn out one of the MacNeils was a traitor, it would be a major scandal. We have very explicit orders to avoid any such thing. And that, gods help us, is where you come in."
"All right, I'll bite. Why us?"
"Well, thanks to you and your partner's incompetence, what description we did have of Fenris is now obsolete. But at least you two have met the man in person. There's always a chance you'll recognize some mannerism or habit that'll give him away. So you are going in there after him, suitably disguised. Your job is to identify Fenris and get him out of the tower without anyone else catching on. It's not much of a plan, so the fact that we're going ahead with it will give you some idea of just how desperate we are. Any questions so far?"
"Yeah, what kind of place is Tower MacNeil?"
"Home to the MacNeils for 14 generations, protected by old sorcery and one of Avon's finest security firms. The head of the family, Duncan MacNeil, died last month, which means, luckily for us, that things are in something of a turmoil at the moment. Now, Duncan's son, Jamie, is to be the new head of the family, the MacNeil, as he's called. And as is customary, all living members of the family will be gathering at Tower MacNeil to pay their respects to the new head and jockey for positions of influence and power. Nothing like a family funeral to bring out the vultures. Fenris will presumably be trying to pass himself off as one of the more remote cousins. This is how we're going to get you in.
Hawk and Fisher looked at each other.
Wait a minute. You mean we're going to be masquerading as quality?
What's the matter? Don't you think you can do it?
Well, that's not the point. The last I heard, passing yourself off as quality was still punishable by death. Is that being waived in our case?
No. Whatever the outcome, officially, you were never there. If you do get caught, we'll disclaim all knowledge of you. This is a very delicate situation.
Hawk thought for a moment.
Is this a volunteer situation?
Yeah, I volunteered you. Given the alternatives, I wouldn't argue if I was you.
We don't like being pressured, Dubois. We don't like it at all.
Dubois fought down an urge to shrink back in his chair as a sudden chill ran through him. Without moving a muscle, Hawk and Fisher had suddenly become dangerous. An air of menace and imminent violence filled the tiny office, as though a slumbering wolf had suddenly awakened and shown its teeth. Dubois paled slightly, but didn't flinch.
Renegade guards tend to have very short lifespans. If anything was to happen to me, you wouldn't even make it to the city gates.
You might be right, Dubois, but I wouldn't count on it if I were you. We've faced worse odds in the past. We'll do your dirty work for you this time. I think we owe it to the council for letting Fenris get away from us. But if you ever try to pressure us like this again, Dubois, I will kill you. Believe it.
Dubois met Hawk's cold stare for a moment and then looked away. When he looked back, Hawk and Fisher were just guards again. The air of violence was gone, as though it had never been. For the first time, Dubois understood how they gained their reputation. He got to his feet.
Let's go. We've got just under 2 hours to turn the pair of you into regular young flowers of the aristocracy and deliver you to Tower MacNeil.
No problem. We can be as aristocratic as the next man, if pushed.
Right. All we have to do is act arrogant and obnoxious at all times and remember not to blow our noses on our sleeves without crooking our little fingers. What could go wrong?
Dubois said nothing. There were times when mere words seemed inadequate. He hustled them out of his office and through the bustling corridors to an anonymous file room safely out of everyone's way. He ushered them in and then locked the door behind them. A guard medical sorcerer rose quickly to his feet, nodded stiffly to the two guards, and looked inquiringly at Dubois. The commander nodded and the sorcerer shrugged. He was a dark and intense-looking man in his early 40s, with a professional smile and large, powerful hands. He was overdressed in a dark, formal way, as though he were about to attend a funeral. Hawk looked at him suspiciously. He didn't trust Haven doctors. They seemed to believe in suppositories for everything, from warts to deafness. He started to turn to Dubois, but Fisher beat him to it.
What's the doctor doing here? We're not sick.
This is Wolfgang. You can trust him completely.
Why? You got something on him, too?
Wolfgang specializes in shape-change magic, in a minor way. Since you both have something of a reputation in Avon, we can't have you walking into Tower MacNeil with your own faces now, can we? Wolfgang will give you new faces, which won't be recognized.
Hawk scowled at the sorcerer.
I'm not feeling too fond of flesh sculptors right now. What's wrong with a good old-fashioned illusion spell?
Tower MacNeil, like most quality households, has security spells to show up such things. The families take their security very seriously. The shape change won't register because the spell will have finished its work long before you get there. Now, after your return, with your mission successfully completed, we'll give you your own faces back.
And if we don't succeed?
You screw up in Tower MacNeil, Hawk, and you won't be coming back. Now, stop holding things up. Let the sorcerer get to work on you. We're running out of time.
Hawk and Fisher looked at each other and then sat down on the chairs Wolfgang indicated. The sorcerer smiled reassuringly and ran his hands through a series of practiced gestures. A gradual feeling of pressure filled the room, and Hawk's skin crawled as static moved in his hair. The pressure peaked uncomfortably and then vanished as the sorcerer made a final, decisive gesture. Hawk waited a moment and then looked down at his hands. They still looked the same to him. He looked across at Fisher, and she looked the same, too. He looked back at the sorcerer Wolfgang, who was staring dumbfounded at the two guards.
Wasn't anything happening?
I don't know. I can't understand it. The spell just seemed to slide off them.
A sudden thought struck him, and he glared at Hawk.
Are you still carrying your suppressor stone?
No, he is not, and don't ask what happened to it. That's confidential.
Wolfgang frowned thoughtfully.
Well, there's nothing wrong with the spell. They're not shielded, so what? Wait a minute. Have you two ever been exposed to wild magic?
What's that got to do with anything?
Well, there's a big difference between the high magic that most sorcerers use and the much rarer wild magic. High magic manipulates aspects of the real world. Wild magic changes reality itself. So if your people have been exposed to wild magic...
We have. We were up north when the blue moon rose.
Dubois and Wolfgang stared at the two guards almost respectfully.
You were there. During the Long Nine?
Yes, we were there, and no, we don't want to talk about it.
That's why my spell won't work on them. If they were exposed to the Blue Moon's influence, it'll take more than a simple shape change spell to affect them. I'm sorry, Commander, there's nothing I can do.
I might have known that you two were going to be trouble. All right, thank you, Wolfgang, that will be all. Wardrobe mistress should have arrived by now. Perhaps you'd be good enough to ask her to step in here on your way out. And Wolfgang, remember, this meeting never took place. You were never here.
Of course.
He bowed politely to Hawk and Fisher and waited patiently for Dubois to unlock the door so he could leave. Dubois locked the door again after he'd gone.
While we're waiting, there's a few things I'd like to get clear. In particular, why Fenris chose Tower McNeil as his hiding place. Surely among so many quality, he'd be bound to give himself away sooner or later.
We have reason to believe Fenris may be of the quality, so he'd have no problem passing himself off as a distant McNeil cousin.
Why the hell would one of the quality want to act as a spy? Most spies work strictly for cash, or occasionally political gain. If there's one thing the quality aren't short of, it's money, and most of them don't give a damn about politics. So what happened to turn Fenris into an agent for a foreign power?
Well, now, if we knew that, we'd know who he was.
Can you at least tell us something about the information he's stolen? That might help when it comes to identifying him.
I can't tell you anything. That's being handled on a strictly need-to-know basis. Even I haven't been told. But it must be pretty damned important to have got everyone running around in circles like this. You would not believe the pressure that's been coming down from above. Yeah, let me put it this way. Under no circumstances is this spy Fenris to be allowed to escape from Tower McNeil. If he tries, you're to stop him, whatever it takes.
You mean kill him?
Whatever it takes.
In other words, it's up to us whether or not we kill a member of the quality. But if anything goes wrong afterwards, everyone will swear blind we were never given any such order, right?
Ooh, you have a natural gift for politics, Hawk.
I was born to it.
Dubois went over to the door.
Who is it?
Mistress Melanie.
On getting a satisfactory answer, he unlocked the door, but he still stood well back as he opened it, one hand resting on his sword till he saw the newcomer was alone. The wardrobe mistress bustled in a hurry, as usual. Mistress Melanie stood before them, tall and scrawny, with a sharp-boned face and a wild frizz of dark, curly hair barely restrained by a leather headband. She was one of those people who had so much nervous energy she made everyone else feel tired just looking at her.
Are they ready?
She addressed Dubois, not even bothering to look at Hawk and Fisher.
Well, the shape change didn't take. We'll have to rely on standard disguise techniques. Do what you can with them.
Mistress Melanie glared at the two guards.
As if we weren't already running behind schedule. All right, follow me and don't dawdle.
And with that, she disappeared back out the door, her words still ringing on the air. Hawk and Fisher hurried after her. A short foot race later, they ended up in the wardrobe department. Hawk had never been there before and looked around with interest. Hundreds of costumes hung in neat rows on wire hangers, everything from the latest quality fashions to a filthy rag picker's outfit. A great deal of the guards' work had to be done undercover, inevitable in a city like Haven, where no one shared confidences unless they had to, and absolutely no one spoke to the authorities, unless there was money in it. Half the guard's annual budget went to information gathering, a fact that never failed to infuriate the more penny-pinching members of the council. Mistress Melanie sat Hawk and Fisher down in front of the makeup mirrors and studied them thoughtfully.
Yes. The scars are going to be a problem, but a good coat of makeup should cover them. No one will be able to tell, even at close quarters, but don't let anyone kiss you.
Well, I hadn't planned on it.
They're going to have to do something about that eye, of course. A patch is out of the question.
She looked hard at Hawk's single eye for a moment. She opened a small lacquered box and rummaged around inside it, finally producing a single glass eye.
Try this.
No, forget it. I hate the damn things.
I can assure you, you'll find it a perfect match.
I said no.
Be reasonable, Hawk. You can't wear your patch. Any member of the quality who suffered that kind of injury would have fixed it with a shape change spell. And since you can't do that, you'll have to use the glass eye. It won't be for long.
Hawk accepted the glass eye with bad grace. He scowled at it for a moment, then took off his patch, put it to one side, and gingerly eased the glass eye into the empty socket. He blinked experimentally a few times, and then glared into the mirror.
Ugh, hate wearing a glass eye. Makes my face ache.
Fisher looked over his shoulder into the mirror.
She's right, Hawk. They're a perfect match. No one will be able to tell it isn't real.
Mistress Melanie produced a set of clothes for each of them and thrust them unceremoniously into Hawk's and Fisher's arms.
Try these for size. They're based on the statistics in your official records, but I've had to make some allowances. From the look of you, you've both put on some weight since then. Come on, get a move on. I've got to know if I have to make more alterations and we've still got your makeup to do.
Hawk looked at her and raised an eyebrow meaningfully. Mistress Melanie's mouth twitched.
I'll wait outside while you change. Call me if you have any problems.
Hawk took his first good look at his new clothes, and his heart sank. The latest male fashion for the quality still consisted of tightly cut trousers, a padded jerkin, and a chin-high collar, and knee-length leather boots, plus some rather utilitarian-looking long underwear. The jerkin and trousers were both navy blue with gold thread trim. The military look was in this season. He looked across at Fisher and smiled as he saw she was even less enchanted with her new clothes. There was a long flowing gown of lilac blue with frothy lace trim, a great deal of frilly underwear, a formidable-looking corset, and a pair of fashionable shoes that looked hideously uncomfortable. Fisher picked up the corset with a thumb and forefinger and held it out at arm's length, studying it dubiously.
Look on the bright side, at least there isn't a bustle.
Do we really have to do this, Hawk?
Well, we could fight our way out of here and make a run for it.
Oh, don't tempt me.
Fisher began stripping off her furs.
The things I do in the line of duty.
It took them the best part of an hour to climb into their new clothes. There were endless buttons and hooks and eyes, and they all had to be done up in just the right order. Hawk could only just get into the trousers. Even with Mistress Melanie's allowances for his somewhat expanded waistline, it was a very tight fit. Fisher had even more trouble with the corset. Hawk ended up having to put a knee in the middle of her back while he pulled the cords tight. Fisher's language became increasingly awful until finally she was forced to give up from lack of breath. Finally, the ordeal was over, and they stood together before a full-length mirror judging the effect. Despite everything, Hawk had to admit they looked the part. Before them in the mirror stood a gentleman and young lady of the quality, dressed impeccably in the latest finery. Hawk looked splendid and striking, though the scars on his face still gave him a sinister air, and Fisher looked absolutely stunning. The corset gave her a magnificent hourglass figure, and the long gown made her look even taller. She winked at Hawk coquettishly over her paper fan.
Been a long time since we looked this good.
A long time.
Mistress Melanie swept in without waiting for an answer. She looked them both up and down and nodded curtly.
You'll do. Now, let's see what we can achieve with a little makeup.
Another half hour passed before the wardrobe mistress allowed Hawk and Fisher to look into a mirror again, and what they saw kept them silent for a long moment. Their skin was now fashionably pale instead of their usual tan. Fisher's face had been expertly made up with rouge and eyeshadow, taking the edge off the harsh lines and softening the aggressive chin. Her long blonde hair sat piled up on top of her head in a complicated design. Hawk's face looked changed completely. With the patch gone and the scars hidden under makeup, he looked 10 years younger and somehow more at peace with himself and the world. Fisher looked at him and smiled tenderly.
I'd almost forgotten what you looked like before the scars.
Well, what do you think?
I think you look very handsome, my love. But then, I always did.
Hawk leaned forward to kiss her.
No touching till the makeup set! I don't want to have to fix her face all over again!
Hawk and Fisher shared a wry smile.
Are you too decent?
Near as we ever get.
Hawk nodded for Mistress Melanie to let the commander in. Hawk and Fisher stood and struck carefully aristocratic poses and stared haughtily at Dubois as he came in. He walked slowly over to them and looked from one to the other and back again.
Well, I'm impressed. You might just bring this off after all. Wish we had time to give you a full briefing on how to behave, all the little tricks of etiquette and the like, but we're way behind schedule as it is.
Don't worry. We know which fork to use and which way to pass the port. We've been around.
Right. You'd be surprised.
Yeah, well, we've worked out a rough background for you. You're going to be remote country cousins of the McNeils, brother and sister from the wilds of Lower Markham. That's way up north, so no one should be able to trip you up on local details. Make up anything you like, they won't know the difference. But keep it simple. You don't want to end up contradicting each other. Also, they'll expect a certain amount of gaucherie and unfamiliarity with the latest style, so that should help excuse any foul-ups you do make. Now then, you're going to have to get used to your new names. Captain Fisher can use her given name of Isabel. That's quite a fashionable name at the moment. But we don't seem to have a given name on the files for you, Captain Hawk.
There isn't one. I'm just Hawk.
You only have the one name.
I've had others, but I'm just Hawk now.
Be that as it may, as far as you're concerned, from now on, you're Richard McNeil. You got it?
Richard? Richard. Yeah, I can live with that.
Oh, I am so pleased. One last thing. Leave your axe here. We'll supply you with a standard dueling sword. And Captain Fisher, you're going to have to go unarmed, of course. No young lady of the quality would wear a sword. It simply isn't done.
Hawk and Fisher looked at each other.
No axe.
No sword.
Tight trousers.
And a corset.
They looked hard at Dubois.
We want a bonus.
In cash.
In our hands, before we go.
I can arrange that.
Hawk looked at Fisher.
They must really be desperate.
Maybe we should hit them for overtime while we're at it.
Don't push your luck.
Haven was an old city, but the dark and brooding cliffs that overlooked it were older still. Huge and forbidding, they rose out of the restless sea like grim, watchful guardians, protecting Haven on three sides from the raging storms that swept in off the sea. The waves pounded endlessly at the jagged spurs of rock, throwing spray high into the wind, even on the calmest of days. Tower McNeil stood firm and unyielding on an outcropping of dark basalt that jutted from the cliff face like a clenched fist against the encroaching sea. The tower was tall and elegant, built entirely from the local white stone with its distinctive pearly sheen. Its lines were clean and functional, the wide glass windows its only concession to comfort and luxury. It stood three stories tall, surmounted by open crenellated battlements. Down the centuries, Tower McNeil had defied both time and the elements, as well as countless enemy attacks. Often scarred, and as often restored, it had never once fallen to its adversaries. Brilliant engineering and subtle sorceries maintained the tower, as it maintained and protected the family who dwelt within. But like the cliffs on which it stood, and the dark city it overlooked, Tower McNeil had its grim and bloody secrets. Within the tower, something had stirred, something strange and awful, free of its chains at last. Hawk trudged up the single narrow path, his cloak pulled tightly about him, his head bowed against the gusting wind. This high up on the cliffs, the wind blew hard and bitter cold. The wild grasses seemed permanently flattened by the weather, and nothing else grew around him as far as he could see. Hawk wasn't surprised, given the force of the winds. Anything that dared thrust its head above the ground was probably ripped out by the roots for its impertinence. He raised his head slightly and scowled as he saw Fisher waiting for him some way ahead, standing on the edge of the cliff and looking out to sea. He took a few deep breaths, fighting to get his breathing back to normal before he joined her. The long, steep trail had winded him, but he didn't want her to know that. She'd only make pointed comments about his being out of condition and put him on another diet. Hawk hated diets. Why did everything that was good for you have to taste so bland? He crossed over to stand beside Fisher on the cliff edge, careful to keep a respectful distance between him and the crumbling stone brink. The wind tugged at his hair and drew tears from his eyes. Fisher nodded at him happily and indicated the view with a sweeping wave of her arm. Hawk had to admit it was pretty breathtaking. Far below, waves pounded the rocks with unrelenting fury, falling reluctantly back in streams of froth and spume. The choppy sea stretched away to the horizon in endless shades of blue and green and gray, empty of sails for once. Winter was closing in, and ships now were few and far between. The steely blue sky was clear of clouds for the moment, thanks to the city weather wizards, and gulls hung on the air like drifting shadows, tossed here and there by the gusting wind. Their mournful keening was all that broke the morning quiet, save for the distant crash of breakers down below.
Listen to the sea and the gulls. So wild, so free. We really should get out here more often, Hawk.
Maybe we will come the summer. And you'd better call me Richard from now on, even when there's no one around. We don't want to get caught out on something that simple.
Sure. Why did we have to be brother and sister? Why couldn't we be husband and wife?
Beats me. Maybe we're supposed to get information out of people by romancing them?
Fisher wrinkled her nose.
Ugh. Not really our style.
True.
I never get tired of looking at the sea. You know, I never even saw the ocean before we left the north.
I like the view too, Isabel, but we can't stay here. We have a job to do, and time is pressing.
I know. It's just that we never seem to have any time to ourselves these days.
When did we ever?
True. Let's go.
They turned away from the cliff edge and made their way back through the grass to the narrow, stony trail. The tower loomed ahead of them, straight and uncompromising against the skyline, silent and enigmatic. Its height made it look deceptively slim until you got close enough to realize just how huge the tower really was. Hawk thought for a moment on how backbreaking it must have been hauling building stone up the cliffs to this spot. Just trying to visualize the logistics was enough to make his head ache. He realized Fisher was staring at the tower, too, and deliberately quickened his step.
Come on, Isabel. There's no telling how long Fenris will stay put in the tower. If he decides to leave before we can get there to stop him, Dubois will have our heads. Probably literally.
I don't know why Fenris doesn't just keep running. I would have. What made him think he'd be safe here?
The longer he stayed in the open, the more likely it was he'd be spotted. And the tower's a good place to go to ground. It's within easy reach of the city, but out of everyone's thoughts. I wouldn't have thought to look for him here. If it hadn't been for the Council's sorcerers, he'd have probably gotten away with it. And let's face it, if worse came to worse, and for some reason the McNeils decided not to hand him over, we'd have one hell of a job getting him out of the tower. You need an army and every sorcerer in the city to breach those walls, by all accounts. No. My guess is Fenris is probably biding his time in there, looking over his shoulder a lot and waiting for one of his own people to contact him with a safe route out to the Low Kingdoms, assuming someone hasn't already done so.
I still haven't figured out what we're going to do once we're inside the tower. I mean, we have no idea what he looks like now. He could be anybody. He could be passing himself off as an out-of-town McNeil cousin like us, or a friend of one, or a newly hired servant, or... hell, I don't know. Command's a spy, after all. He's used to pretending to be someone he isn't. How are we going to trip up someone like that? This case is a mess, and we've barely even started yet. Do you think we're going to be able to recognize him?
Not a hope. If I had to fight him again, I might recognize his style. But I'm damned if I'm going to go around challenging everyone to a duel. Especially without my axe. Have you seen this stupid sword they gave me? One good parry and it'll snap in half. I'd be better off sneaking up behind my opponent and clubbing him to death with the hilt.
So, what are we going to do?
Same as usual, Isabel. Ask lots of questions, keep our eyes open, and hopefully make enough of a nuisance of ourselves that the killer will do something stupid to try and shut us up.
Great. I just love being a target.
They finally drew near to Tower McNeil. The large, squarish front door was a different shade of white from the surrounding stonework, and Hawk felt a sudden, unsettling thrill go through him as he realized the door had been carved from a single huge slab of polished ivory. He tried to visualize the size of the whale that could donate such a bone, and quickly decided he'd rather not know. Hawk tugged briskly at the bell pull, and then he and Fisher took turns using the black iron boot scraper. They were quality now, and had to keep up appearances. The door swung smoothly open on well-oiled counterweights, revealing a medium-height, heavy-set man in his mid-40s, wearing the slightly outdated formal wear that was the accepted hallmark of the Haven butler. He had dark, lifeless hair, a flat, immobile face that might have been carved from stone, and a general air of gloomy efficiency for which the long black frock coat was the perfect finishing touch. He bowed formally to Hawk and Fisher, each bow nicely calculated to the inch to show respect for his betters, whilst reminding them that as butler of the household he was a force to be reckoned with in his own right. It was a masterful performance. Hawk felt like applauding.
I am Richard McNeil of Lower Markham. This is my sister, Isabel. We've come to pay our respects to the new head of the family.
Of course, sir and madam. I am Greaves. Please come in.
He stood back to allow them to enter. He seemed fairly disapproving, possibly because they came from a backwater like Lower Markham, but most likely because butlers always seemed faintly disapproving. Hawk suspected it was part of the job description. He strolled into the hallway as though he owned the place, with Isabel on his arm, smiling demurely. The smile didn't suit her, but Hawk admired the effort she put into it. Greaves closed the door behind them, and Hawk's ears pricked up as he heard the sound of heavy bolts thrown home. It could be the Tower McNeil household was routinely security-minded, or it could be that right now they had reason to be. He took off his cloak and found the butler already there waiting to receive it. Fisher handed Greaves her cloak and raised a painted eyebrow inquiringly.
Are you the only staff here, Greaves? Surely it's not a butler's place to take the cloaks from guests. Don't you have any maids under you?
Greaves' expression didn't alter in the least as he arranged the cloaks neatly on the wall by the door.
Alas, madam, I'm afraid Tower McNeil is extremely short-staffed at present. Normally we have a staff of 22, but everyone else left some time ago.
And why is that?
It's not really my place to say, sir. If you and the young lady would care to follow me, I'll take you to the McNeil himself. I'm sure he will be happy to answer any questions you may have.
He turned his back on them, politely but firmly, and started off down the hall. Hawk and Fisher exchanged a look behind his back, shrugged pretty much in unison, and followed him. They'd only been in the place a few moments, and already they were up to their ears in questions. What the hell could have happened here to drive all the servants out? And since it had happened recently, could it have something to do with Fenris's arrival? The butler worried Hawk as well. The man was being far too calm and pleasant. Most butlers were worse snobs than their masters and would have had coronaries at the mere mention of their doing maid's work. And yet Greaves seemed to be implying he was doing all the servants' work at Tower McNeil. What kind of hold could keep him at his duty despite the humiliation? Hawk shrugged inwardly. Perhaps Greaves was just angling for a larger-than-usual gratuity when Hawk left, in which case he was going to be disappointed. Wardrobe might have provided Hawk with aristocratic clothes, but they'd absolutely declined to fill the purse on his belt. He'd had to do that with his bonus money, and he was damned if he was going to part with one penny more than he absolutely had to. The butler led Hawk and Fisher down a stylishly appointed passage and ushered them into a large and spacious drawing room. Early morning light streamed through the immaculately polished windows, reflecting brightly from the pure white of the stonework, illuminating the room like a vision of paradise. The whole ceiling was covered with a single delightful piece of art depicting nymphs and shepherds at play, in a romantic and extremely tasteful way, of course. Everywhere there were luxurious chairs and couches, fine displays of wines and spirits, silver trays bearing all kinds of cold food, and every other comfort the mind could imagine. Hawk did his best to look unimpressed. Standing with his back to the roaring fire was a tall, well-built young man with broad shoulders and a barrel chest. He couldn't have been more than 20, and his unruly mop of tawny hair made him look even younger. Nevertheless, there was a dignity and strength in his stance, and a composure in his face that was quietly impressive. Hawk didn't need Greaves to tell him this was their host, Jamie McNeil, the McNeil, as he now was. He stood before them, dressed all in black, still in mourning for his father, but the clothes were of the finest cut and impeccably fashionable. He stepped forward as the butler introduced them and greeted his two cousins warmly.
Isabel!
He kissed Isabel's hand with style.
Richard.
And shook Hawk's hand in a grip that was firm without being overbearing. He gestured for the butler to leave them, and Greaves bowed and backed out. Jamie led Hawk and Fisher over to the drinks cabinet. He seemed genuinely pleased to see them, and yet somehow preoccupied, as though part of his attention was always somewhere else.
So good of you to come. Did you have a good journey?
bearable.
Hawk accepted his drink with a nod of thanks.
We left our belongings in Haven, ghastly place, and came straight here, though I gather from your butler that we may have arrived at a bad time. He said something about all the servants leaving?
Jamie McNeil smiled easily, but Hawk could see the effort it took.
Just a minor domestic crisis, but I'm afraid we're going to have to rough it for the moment. Please accept my apologies and bear with us. Do feel free to stay for as long as you wish. There are plenty of spare bedrooms, and Haven's Inns are notoriously unsafe.
That's very kind of you.
Oh, not at all, not at all. Just let Greaves know, and he'll prepare rooms for you.
He reached for the bell pull by the fireplace, but had barely taken hold of it when Greaves entered the room. Hawk blinked bemusedly at such a quick response, and then smiled slightly as Greaves stepped to one side, and two ladies of the quality swept in, not even deigning to notice the butler's bow. Jamie smiled at them both, a genuine smile, full of warmth and affection and more than a little concern. Hawk sipped his wine thoughtfully as Jamie crossed the room and spoke quietly to the butler. Hawk was beginning to get a bad feeling about Tower McNeil. Something was going on here, something he was beginning to suspect had nothing to do with the spy Fenris. He took a healthy gulp of his wine, careful to keep his little finger extended. On the other hand, he could just be getting paranoid. If Jamie McNeil knew about the spy, then getting rid of a bunch of gossiping servants was a sensible precaution. But according to Greaves, the servants had left some time ago, long before Fenris could have arrived. Hawk quickly put the thought to one side for later consideration, as Jamie dismissed the butler and turned to him and Fisher.
Dear cousins, allow me to present my sister, Holly, and my aunt, Katrina Dorimont.
Hawk bowed, and the women all curtsied, Fisher with more efficiency than grace. Holly McNeil was a blazing redhead in her late 20s, almost as tall as her brother, but as slightly built as he was broad. Hawk's first thought was that the poor girl could do with a good meal or two. Her pale face was gaunt and strained, though still attractive, her large green eyes giving her an innocent, vulnerable look, like a young fawn suddenly confronted with a pack of wolves. Whatever was going on at Tower McNeil, it was clear she knew about it too. Like her brother, Holly McNeil was formally but stylishly dressed in black, which against the paleness of her skin only served to emphasize her frailty. She offered Hawk a trembling hand, and he had to steady it with his own before he could kiss it. He gave her hand a reassuring squeeze before releasing it, and thought he glimpsed a quick smile. Holly and Fisher embraced each other briefly. There was no warmth in it, and Holly held the contact only as long as convention demanded. Jamie's aunt, Katrina Dorimont, was an attractive woman in her mid-40s, with a broad grin and flashing eyes. She wore a long wine-red gown and enough jewelry to finance a minor war or two. She was average height, with a tight, compact body and a brisk, captivating manner. She smiled widely at Hawk as he kissed her hand, and her eyes lingered on him for a long moment before she turned to embrace Fisher. Once again, the embrace was over almost as soon as it had begun, and the two women exchanged a cool, appraising look before dismissing each other with averted eyes. Hawk hid a smile. Fisher had better keep her guard up. Katrina looked like a scrapper. She smiled at her guests.
Welcome to Tower McNeil. I'm so glad you're here. We need some new blood to stir things up. The place has been awfully gloomy just lately, though I can't think why. Dear Duncan never approved of sour faces when he was alive, and he certainly wouldn't have expected us to wander around sobbing and beating our breasts just because he's dead.
You never did believe in tears or regrets, did you, Aunt?
Certainly not. They make your eyes puffy and give you wrinkles.
Are you here for the reading of the will?
Actually, no, my dear. I'm currently separated from my husband, and dear Jamie has been kind enough to allow me to stay here until the divorce is finalized.
I had in mind a few weeks, Auntie. In actual fact, you've been here 5 months now.
Don't exaggerate, dear. It's 4 and a bit.
Are we the only guests? I can't believe we're the only family come to pay our respects to the McNeil.
There are other guests. They're upstairs in their rooms at present, but they'll be joining us for late breakfast soon. We keep very relaxed hours here, especially since the servants left. But it must be said, there aren't nearly as many families here as one might have wished for.
Why not?
The three McNeils exchanged a quick glance.
I take it you've never heard of the McNeil curse. Not really surprising, I suppose, buried as you are in the depths of Lower Markham. It's not something we're proud of. and we don't care to discuss it with outsiders, but since you're both family, and you've come all this way to be here, the curse is the reason so few have come to pay their respects, even with the reading of the will to tempt them. It's why the servants ran away. It's why the quality no longer accept invitations to Tower McNeil. Please, be seated, all of you, and I'll tell you of the secret shame of the McNeils, and how it has come to haunt us. I think it's time for the truth.
Everyone found themselves chairs and drew them up in a semicircle, facing the fireplace. Jamie stayed where he was, with his back to the fire, standing almost to attention, with his hands clasped behind his back, so the others wouldn't see them shaking.
Most people have heard something about the curse of the McNeils, that there is a monster hunting us, and has done for generations. There have been many songs about it, and even one or two plays. Romantic fiction, all of them. We don't object. They help conceal the reality behind the myth. There is a secret in our family, handed down from father to eldest son alone, from generation to generation. Long ago, in the days before proper records were kept, a child was born to the McNeils, to the head of the family at the time. The child was the eldest son, destined to continue the family bloodline. Unfortunately, he was also horribly deformed. He should have been killed at birth. But the McNeil was a kind and tender-hearted man. The creature was, after all, his son. Perhaps a cure could be found. The McNeil all but bankrupted his family trying to find it, paying for doctors and sorcerers and healers of all kind to no avail. The creature became increasingly violent and eventually had to be put away for everyone's sake. The McNeil took full responsibility for his awful son, and none of the family or servants ever saw it again. Finally, some years later, the creature died, and everyone heaved a sigh of relief. The normal second son became the eldest son. The bloodline continued through him, and everything returned to normal. That is not the secret. The songs and the romances and the plays are based loosely on what I have just told you. And from those distorted stories come the vague rumors that most people mean when they refer to the curse of the McNeils. The secret, handed down from father to eldest son, is very simple. The creature did not die. The McNeil finally despaired of his monstrous son and decided it should die to free the family of its burden. He gave the creature poison to drink and walled up his room. The McNeil and the second son did the job themselves, rather than risk bringing in workmen or servants who might have talked. And all the time they labored with bricks and mortar, they could hear the creature pacing restlessly back and forth in its cell. The poison did not kill it. Time and again, the McNeil and his son returned to listen at the wall they'd built. But though the creature had no access to food or water, still it lived. They could hear it moving about in its cell and sometimes scratching at the walls. Years passed. The McNeil died, and later so did his son, but the creature lived on. No one ever knew of its existence save the head of the family and the eldest son. The secret, passing from generation to generation to generation when the son reached his majority. And so it went, down all the many years, only this time something went wrong. My father passed on the secret to his eldest son, my brother, William. But William died just 3 weeks ago in a riding accident, and then my father was killed in a border clash before he could pass on the details of the secret to me. I was able to piece together what I've just told you from studying his papers after his death, but that's as far as his notes go. Presumably, there are other papers somewhere, prepared in case of an emergency, but I've been unable to find them. No doubt my father would have got around to telling me where they were, just in case. But who would ever have thought he'd die so suddenly?
Holly rose quickly from her seat and moved forward to hug her brother's arm protectively.
Is that why the servants left? Because the secret got out?
No. Not long after father died, the servants began seeing things. A dark figure, padding through the corridors late at night, or in the early hours of the morning. It always disappeared when challenged. I had the tower searched from top to bottom by my security people, but they never found anyone. Then things started to break. Vases, glasses, crockery. A chair was found smashed to pieces. Noises sounded in the night. Something that might have been screams or laughter. My people began to leave. Despite all I could offer them in the way of money or reassurance, even my security people wouldn't stay. They all thought it was the ghost of my father, come back to haunt the tower. Only I knew better. After all these years, the creature finally got out. Obviously, some part of the secret dealt with how to keep it confined, and since I didn't know what to do, so far, it hasn't been able to leave Tower McNeil. The tower's protective wards see to that.
Why haven't you called in the city guard? Maybe their experts could find the creature and...
No! This is family business, and it has to stay within the family. If the secret ever gets out, the whole world will know the McNeil family is based on a lie. That all of us are descended from a second son. The quality would declare that we had betrayed our bloodline and inheritance, and the McNeils would be disgraced. Already there are rumors. That's why so few family have come to declare their fealty to me.
Apart from us, who else knows the secret?
Just Greaves, my immediate family, and my other guests so far.
This creature, has it tried to hurt anyone?
Not so far, but it is getting more destructive. Why? Do you want to leave?
I don't think so. Isabel and I don't scare easily.
Katrina stirred in her chair.
I can't believe Duncan kept the secret so long. I had no idea. You're quite right, of course, Jamie. The secret must never get out. We would be ostracized in high society. Now then, the creature undoubtedly hides by day in the room that used to be its cell. Are you still unable to locate it?
I'm afraid so. The tower is riddled with secret passages and sliding panels. I know some of them, and Father's papers revealed a few more, but I still haven't been able to find what the creature is hiding. Presumably the room's location was part of the secret.
This is beyond belief. If this creature was walled up for centuries, what kept it alive? Everything feeds on something.
I don't know, but whatever the creature is, it's definitely not human. Maybe it hasn't died because it can't.
For a long time, nobody said anything.
All this started because the McNeil died unexpectedly. Just how did he die?
Katrina looked at him sharply.
You don't know?
Word often alters when it has to travel long distances. We want to make sure of the accuracy of our information.
I was just wondering if perhaps there had been something unusual about your father's death. Something that might give us a clue as to how the creature got out of its cell after centuries of confinement. You say its room is bricked up. How did it get out?
I see. I hadn't thought of that. But no, there was nothing suspicious about my father's death. He was killed in a skirmish with Outremer troops up in the northern borderlands. He shouldn't really have been there, an officer of his rank. But there had been rumors of new troop movements, and he wanted to see for himself. Father was like that, never really trusted anyone's opinion but his own. Anyway, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he and his whole column were wiped out. Just another borderland skirmish. There's been a number of them recently. Men are dying up there every day. Just because our king and the Outremer monarch can't agree on exactly where the bloody border is. Good men dying for a line on a map. I'm sorry, but it's hard not to be bitter sometimes. Father was a good soldier. He deserved a better end than this. But I don't see how it could have had anything to do with the creature's escape.
Did anything unusual happen here at the tower before the servants started seeing and hearing things?
I don't think so. I remember we were a bit short-staffed for a while about then. A lot of the servants going down with colds. But you expect that at that time of year, a day off, and they're back at work again.
There's really nothing to worry about. You'll be quite safe here, I assure you. There's no indication the creature's ever tried to hurt anyone. That is right, isn't it, Jamie?
Yes, it is. But I felt it only fair that you should all know what the situation is. You see, before the will can be read, the tower has to be isolated behind protective wards for 24 hours. That's traditional.
You mean once the wards are up, no one can leave the tower for a full day? No matter what happens here.
He and Fisher exchanged a quick glance.
That's right. But trust me, nothing's going to happen. If the creature had meant any harm, it would have acted by now. All those years of imprisonment must have knocked the fight out of it.
I'm sure you're right. But you couldn't have known that at the beginning. In fact, it must have been quite scary, especially when the servants started leaving rather than face whatever it was. Why did you stay? Wouldn't it have been safer to evacuate the tower?
This is my home. Home to my family for generations. I won't be driven out of it.
Well, Well, if all else fails, we can always call on the Guardian.
Who?
The McNeils looked at him strangely. Hawk silently cursed. He knew he should have insisted on a full briefing. Nothing was more likely to trip him and Fisher up than not recognizing some family in-joke or reference, and this was clearly one of them. Still, the harm was done now. All he could do was try to face it down. He stared innocently back at Jamie and Katrina and noticed for the first time that Holly wasn't paying any attention to the conversation. Instead, her eyes were far away, as though she were lost in some world of her own.
You must have heard of the McNeil Guardian. Perhaps you know him by a different name. The Guardian is one of our more pleasant and comforting family legends. One of our more remote ancestors is supposed to haunt the tower, duty-bound to protect his descendants from harm. Apparently, it's a penance for some bloody crime he later came to regret but was unable to put right while he lived. The legend doesn't say exactly what his crime might have been.
Well, that's often the way with legends. I recognize the character now. We refer to it as the Sentinel. Has anyone seen this ghost in recent times?
No one's seen him for centuries, though there have been any number of times when the family could have used his help. So I'm afraid it isn't just a legend after all.
I believe in him. I pray every night he'll come and save me. But he never does.
Everyone looked at her strangely for a moment. For the first time, there had been real passion in her voice, and something that might have been despair. Jamie looked at her worriedly, but said nothing. And Holly quickly subsided into silence again.
That's supposed to be a portrait of the Guardian.
She indicated a dark and gloomy portrait directly over the fireplace.
Painted not long before his death. It's certainly old enough, so who knows?
They all looked at the portrait. The pigments had darkened gradually over the years, but the image was still clear. The portrait showed a grim, unsmiling, middle-aged man posed uncomfortably in a large, upholstered chair. He was dressed in battered leather armor, and his face was lined and weathered. He looked as though he would have been more at home riding a horse into combat than sitting for an official family portrait. There was an air of strength and wildness about him, and his great mane of white hair and sharp-beaked nose reminded Hawk uncannily of a bird of prey, trained to duty but never tamed. Hawk had no trouble at all seeing him as a man who would do bloody crimes in the heat of passion. Everyone jumped slightly as the butler Greaves entered. He stepped to one side.
Messrs. Mark and Alistair McNeil.
The two men entered together, though with enough space between them to suggest they were neither comfortable nor happy in each other's company. They both bowed briefly to Jamie McNeil. Mark was tall and slender, with a broad, bland face and a cool, unhappy smile. He looked to be in his late 20s, if you ignored his prematurely thinning hair, and he wore the latest fashion poorly, as though indifferent to the effect it was supposed to achieve. He looked like the kind of man who attaches himself to groups at parties in the hope someone will talk to him. His handshake was harsh and perfunctory, and his lips lingered almost obnoxiously over Fisher's hand. Jamie introduced him as another distant cousin from Upper Markham.
That makes him almost a neighbor of yours. I'm sure you'll have lots in common to talk about.
Oh, good.
I rather doubt it. No one worth knowing ever came out of Lower Markham.
There was an icy silence. Hawk's hand fell to his belt before remembering he didn't have his axe anymore. Fisher quickly dropped a restraining hand on his arm. Mark smiled stiffly, almost as though daring Hawk to take offense at such an obvious truth.
That's enough. There will be no duels in the tower while I'm the McNeil. Now apologize, Mark.
Of course. I'm sorry.
His tone made the apology sound like another insult, and Hawk's scowl deepened. Fisher tightened her grip on his arm. Hawk bowed stiffly and turned his back on Mark to greet Alistair McNeil. Mark turned away to help himself to a drink from one of the wine decanters set out on the sideboard. Fisher let go of Hawk's arm and took a long drink from her glass. Alistair shook Hawk's hand firmly and kissed Fisher's hand with old-fashioned style. He smiled at them both, an open, friendly smile that did much to dispel the cool atmosphere left by Mark's comments.
Good of you to make such a long journey. It can't have been easy, getting here from Lower Markham at this time of year.
Well, we felt we ought to be here. Did you have far to come?
Oh, quite a way. I'm another of those cousins the family doesn't like to admit to knowing. I was brought up here in the tower, but the family packed me off to the Red Marches when I was a young man. Got a parlor maid into trouble and couldn't pay my gambling debts. Nothing too outrageous. But someone thought I needed to be made an example of, so off I went. Can't say I regret it. I could have come back long ago, but never saw the point. Lovely area, the Red Marches. Marvelous scenery, good hunting, and always a chance for some action on the borders. That's how I heard about Duncan's death. Beastly bad luck, by all accounts. So, I decided it was time to come back and pay my respects to the new McNeil. Good of you to put me up, Jamie. I couldn't stick Haven. Place has gone to the dogs. Not at all how I remember it.
Hawk studied the man unobtrusively while he spoke. Alistair McNeil was tall and muscular, though obviously well into his 50s. His stomach was intimidatingly flat, his back poker straight, and if Alistair was carrying a few extra pounds anywhere, Hawk was damned if he could spot them. His clothes were undeniably old-fashioned, but exquisitely cut, and Alistair wore them with unconscious style. His iron-gray hair was cropped close to his head, military fashion, but he had the same beaked nose and piercing eyes as the man in the portrait. Alistair caught Hawk glancing from him to the portrait over the fire and chuckled dryly.
There is a resemblance, isn't there? You're not the first to spot it. Doesn't look such a bad type to me. Probably just too much energy and not enough wars to keep him occupied.
Don't glorify the man.
Mark stared up at the portrait, a large drink in his hand.
A soldier in those days was just a paid killer, nothing more. All his masters had to do was point him in the right direction and turn him loose. Probably killed women and children, too, if they got in his way.
They were hard times. The Low Kingdoms faced threats on all sides. The minstrels like to sing of honor and glory, but there's damn all glory for the quicker the dead on a battlefield. There's just the blood and the flies, and the knowledge it will all have to be done again tomorrow. You should try a spell in the army yourself, Mark. You might learn a few things.
If you say so.
Mark turned his back on Alistair and stared coldly at Jamie.
May I inquire how much longer we have to wait before the reading of the will? The sooner this tedious ritual is over and done with, the better. The tower is undoubtedly charming for its age, but I have business to attend to in Haven.
We'll get to the will soon enough. There are two more guests to join us, and then breakfast will be served. I think we'll all feel better for a good meal before getting down to business.
I'm not hungry.
You speak for yourself.
A faded-looking jester hurried into the room, unannounced by the butler. At least Hawk assumed the man was a jester. He couldn't see any other reason for wearing an outfit like that, short of an extremely convincing death threat. Personally speaking, Hawk would rather have taken his chances with the death threat. The newcomer was a rotund little man, brimming with eager, nervous energy. His bright eyes flashed indiscriminately in every direction, much like his smile, and his quick bow to Jamie McNeil was little more than a familiar nod. The newcomer was well into his 60s and looked it, but his costume looked to be even older. It had clearly started out life as a bright and gaudy coat of many colors, but over the many years, the colors had faded, stitches had burst, and a whole mess of new patches, clearly more functional than decorative, had been added. And then, finally, Hawk saw the guitar in the man's hand, and his heart sank.
Minstrel. I hate minstrels.
Jamie smiled briefly at the man, and then turned to his guests.
My friends, this is my minstrel, Robbie Brennan. Been with this family for almost 30 years, haven't you, Robbie? I have to leave for a moment, so play something for my guests. Some tale of my father's exploits and his memory.
Brennan nodded cheerfully, tried a few quick dissonant chords, and launched into an up-tempo ballad.